Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make our community tick. Boy, I don't know if there's another human being in the universe who makes our community tick more than Rafael Ramos, for a lot of reasons. And he's here in the studio today on Dateline to tell us the new reason, the new way he's going to make New Haven tick. Rafael, welcome back, as always, to WNHH.
Thank you, Paul.
And Rafael, because he works in the public health department now, we're going to talk about that, is masked, just so listeners know, there's not someone else within the area 6 feet or more. The social distancing here, everyone vaccinated, but Rafael's being extra careful. Rafael Ramos has been for many years, I guess since the 90s, in the Livable City Initiative, the city's anti-blight organization. He, more than anybody, makes sure that someone's heat is cut off in the dead of winter. If slumlords are keeping people in dangerous conditions, he made sure it got fixed, somebody paid, and somebody got safe. Rafael is also one of our community leaders, civic leaders. He takes kids camping out of Fairhaven, out of Hunt for Progressive Action. He runs Bergamo's theater troupe, community theater. He does a lot of music. Am I leaving out anything major, Rafael?
You got it. These days.
And when there's a problem in the community, you step up. But Rafael, some news. Rafael, how many years have you been at LCI?
Since 1996.
All right, and sort of when things were starting to get going by protecting immigrants, housing conditions. I remember we did a lot of stories about that. You're leaving LCI, but you're staying in city government.
Yes, I am.
What date is that happening? What is your new job?
My new job starts October 4th,
mm-hmm.
and I will be the Director of Environmental Health Programs.
Is that in the health department?
Yes, it's in the health department.
All right, so one of the star departments in New Haven. That job has been vacant for 2 years, hasn't it?
I think so, yes.
Was that Paul Kowalski had it since 1840?
Paul Kowalski had it for a long time.
Yeah, and what's that job? I'll tell you how I understand and tell me what it really is. The Director of Community of Environmental Health Programs, is that someone who goes around trying to tell the community about problems like lead paint, asbestos, in where they live and where they work that might endanger them or their children, and that you try to get them information about how they, if they own a house, how they can get money to get it fixed, or how they can prevent it in general. Is that the right way to put it?
Yeah, that's one phase.
Okay, what's the big thing?
So the big picture is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the residents of New Haven or the public in general by enforcing the state public health code, state statutes related to the code, mm-hmm. and the local ordinances related to public health.
So what kind of risk are you talking? So we're not talking about, in your old job, it would be the wiring can't be loose, you can't have mold coming through, you can't have ceiling tiles falling down, you can't have porches collapsing. What are the rules you're enforcing now?
Now there's food protection program where we have, the health department has sanitarians that go out and they protect the public by regulating restaurants, making sure that they meet the standards.
Will they be under you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the lead program, which is to protect children from the hazards of lead paint, mm-hmm. or lead paint dust. And so primarily that program, which provides a lot of education and intervention and enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the beach water quality, public swimming pools.
Okay. And we've been seeing that. Every time it rains now, with climate change, we have a lot more big storms. And with a lot more big storms, we have a lot of, I think, sewage overflowing that doesn't go into the storm sewers. And that we have a lot of poop showing up in the
So
harbor and in rivers, right?
Yeah, so we have to change how we do and what we do along with the climate change. Mm-hmm. Mostly probably with the redo of some infrastructure, sewers, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Now, so are those the three main areas you have?
Those are the three main areas. There's also weights and measures.
I love weights and measures.
Yeah.
That's where you make sure they're not lying when they tell you if you got a pound of ham or half a pound
right,
of ham.
Right, right. They don't stick a magnet underneath the scale back in the old days. I guess today would be different because it's all electronic.
Right, you kind of tinker with it. Are you going to be doing a lot of that?
No, but I will be supervising the person that does.
Now, in all these four cases, are you supervising?
Yes.
So what's that like for FEL not to be out in the field? Because as a supervisor at LCI, you were out in the field. You were there on the porch.
Yeah, well, I'm that type of person. My new boss has a lot of goals for me, and a lot of she has a list already of stuff that you know that she'll have me do it. But I'm also a field person, and I like to get out with the staff and see what it is that
you will be. You know, no working doubt. With. So how many people are you going to be overseeing in those 4 years?
Approximately 15.
Uh huh.
Yeah,
and they're all inspectors.
Going from 22 to 15.
What do you mean?
Well, 22 I had 22 at LCI.
Mm-hmm.
I have 15.
And just so our listeners, so Rafael Ramos, you're leaving LCI and code inspection, and then you're going to be going to become the director of environmental health programs. And what that means is you're going to be overseeing sanitarians who check that restaurants aren't poisoning you. Lead paint program, which has been a lot of controversy under Marissa Bond, the health director. You've made a lot of changes, both in what the standards are, how much a lead paint needs to be there before you have to remediate it, as well as I think you have more enforcers, right? And you're working
That's
with
correct.
More. And you got more money coming in, right, for people to get help to fix it. So beach water quality, is it just beach water? You said also swimming
beach water,
pools.
Swimming pools, public pools.
And public pools, and then weights and measures.
Weights and measures. So, it's also that we don't have many, but septic systems and mm-hmm. water quality type things.
So are you excited about this?
I'm like, very excited. I am very excited about this.
What excites you about it?
Well, as you know, I did. I came into the whole public health thing through as a lead inspector many years ago in 1992, 93.
No, I didn't know about that. Where were you working then?
I did in Bridgeport, the public health department in Bridgeport.
So you're going back to your root?
Yeah, yeah, going back to the root. So I think
that was your entree into public service and government?
Yes.
And then you came to New Haven in 96.
Then I came to New Haven in 96 as a housing code inspector.
Housing code. And then, so you're going back to your roots, but what are you excited about exactly? You're making a change. You did something for a long time, and I respect that a lot, by the way.
Yeah.
That you were able. It's hard for all of us to continue to find the energy and the inspiration to tackle the same job you've done for 25 years. You did that 25 years, Rafael.
Yeah.
You know, 11, 1 in the morning call, someone's freezing, they're huddled with their kids, the heat's out. What is exciting you about this change?
I love challenges. Mm-hmm. As you know, if I take 60 kids camping, you know I love challenges. So, but I love challenges, and I am very passionate about the whole lead paint lead paint poisoning prevention. Mm-hmm. Something that is totally preventable through education and enforcement, but more so the education piece.
Do you think that's more important than the enforcement?
Yeah, I think the education is more important than the enforcement.
So what are you going to be doing with the education? So the education, we used to have a critique of that program, which was that twice a year or once a year, the person I had a job before would take someone at Lighthouse Point. He'd invite kids from all around town. So now we're going to teach you all about how to get all the families for a picnic at Lighthouse Point.
Yeah.
And most people are not going to end up at a picnic two bus rides away or whatever, away from their neighborhoods to find out how they're supposed to look out for lead paint, get tested while other stuff's going on in their lives, or if they own a place. Are you doing something different from that, or is it the Lighthouse Picnic again?
Well, no, I'm taking my lead and my directions from Director Bond.
Mm-hmm. Marissa Bond, who's the health director.
Correct. And Marissa Bond wants this education and this outreach to happen. In fact, they're already doing it in the neighborhoods proper. New Hallville, Fairhaven.
And how's it being done?
Those kind of things. Excuse me?
How's it being done?
I think it's being done through whenever there is some activity in the community, she sends out a team.
You mean if there's an event?
An event.
Like,
events
like Dixwell gets lit last week, the Elm City Lit Fest.
Right. Those type of things. So
you flyer, you talk to people at events?
They fly, they talk to people, they do that type of outreach. More importantly, I think that she's had a couple of events where workers, maintenance men are trained. This thing called RRP, renovate, write, and paint.
Right.
Which renovate, write,
okay,
and paint, which teaches you to be cognizant of the toxin dust that you're working with.
Mm.
Teaches you to respect the dust and also protect the environment, particularly occupied property. So mm-hmm. she now has these programs going where people are actually getting trained for free.
And how do people get linked up? Do you go to like the main landlords like Mandy and Ocean and say, send us your people?
Yeah, so they have an outreach person doing that. Yeah. And so I know that I sent a couple of people, I think a month and a half ago, as still working in LCI, I think it's very important. And
so that's a good idea.
It's a fantastic. Like I said, it's through education. I'm a true believer in voluntary compliance. Now, I know that's an oxymoron, but what I mean by that is that if we can...
Gun to your head isn't voluntary compliance.
So what I mean by that is if we can get people to comply with these ordinances, codes, and regulations through education, by educating them and telling them why we need them to do these kind of things, and they do it voluntarily, it goes along a further, goes a lot further.
And also, we don't have enough money to enforce it everywhere all the time.
Oh, that's correct.
So it's best if you could do that. What about enforcement? Are you going to crack the whip if they
don't? Well, enforcement is a process, and we're going to make sure it's followed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's a process from a notification to from a conversation to a notification to a deadline.
But how many lead paint inspectors do we have now?
I think there are approximately five.
And how many were there before?
I don't know. I think maybe three.
Mm-hmm.
No, two.
And also, it's partly numbers and partly how they do their job.
Correct.
And is it mostly people calling you with complaints, or do you go out and check it out on your own?
Well, and there's I think the process is you get notifications from clinics, doctors, physicians, or the state. And then sometimes there are folks who are inquiring, what do I do about it?
And why do we care about this? Why do we care about lead paint, about restaurants being clean, about being told the truth when you're buying a pound of ham? Why does this matter? Why does the average person, how are their lives affected?
Overall, it impacts the quality of life as a whole, right? I mean, if you're getting robbed at the scale, then you buy less food to eat, right? You know, right?
With gas, too, right?
Right. If a child gets lead poisoning, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that child will never catch up to his life, right? I mean, not all cases, but, you know, in many cases, it's damaging. It affects your learning ability. It affects your behavior, all those kind of things. So it's very important. Overall, all these things affect the quality. People go out to eat. They get sick, right? There's ways where we can prevent that through education and regulations.
All right, we're talking to Rafael Ramos, one of the great community heroes in New Haven, both in his day jobs working for the city of New Haven and as a civic leader here on Dateline New Haven, WNHH-FM. And Raphael's moving on to a new challenge at the city. After 25 years with New Haven, he didn't take the golden handshake. He didn't retire. He could have gotten his full pension, right? 25 years?
Somewhat, yeah.
Why didn't you take the pension? Why'd you do this?
Well, I'm not ready to retire.
How old are you now, Raphael?
I am 64, actually.
Okay. Yeah. So you're ready to take on something new. You're not just not retiring. You're not taking, like, the thing you've done before and just kind of clocking it in. You're taking on a big new challenge.
Yes.
Because the city did identify this a couple of years ago. This became a big issue in town. Lawsuits to the city settled on lead paint. People were saying this is an important issue in New Haven. We care a lot about lead paint. We care a lot about the quality of our water. We care a lot about enforcing public health. And you're taking that on, man.
Yeah, you know, I care a lot about children.
Uh-huh. That's right. And so, Rafael Ramos, let me look back a little bit. How did you start going to government service? Where did you grow up? Was it New York?
I grew up in New York City, and I came to New Haven in 1987, and the financial center was a hole in the ground, the building next door. And my first job was I was a construction cost estimator for a concrete company.
Oh.
Called Watson and Sons.
Watson and Sons, yeah.
Yeah, he was the general contractor.
Working for David Chase.
Yes. And I worked for him for a year and a half. When we poured the last floor, I got laid off.
Do you go back there and think anything about seeing the big building that rose above that? That was like 30 floors or something.
Yeah. Say that again. I'm sorry. I missed that.
Do you feel any pride when you walk by every day? Every day when you go to work, you're passing by the building, you pour the concrete. I just wonder what that was like when you play a role in getting a building started.
Yeah, it was interesting. I got off the train, walked downtown, and went into the first construction trailer that I saw and got it hired.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing.
And you bought a house in Fairhaven. So you commuted to Bridgeport when you were working lead paint?
And I commuted to Bridgeport.
So you wanted to come back and work closer to home.
Right. So after I got laid off, I went to work at the Y as a outreach worker working with homeless men. at the YMCA at on Howe Street. And it turns out that we couldn't house, part of the problem was, addiction was part of the problem. So we had to get them to programs. And in order to get them to the program, I had to do so many kind of things, to include bathe them.
Really?
So it was very interesting. But in doing that job, I wasn't making any money at all on that job. But I met everybody and anybody who ran New Haven.
Really?
Through that job.
Is that because they played hoops there?
Yeah, well, you know, it was...
I mean, the politicians used to play basketball over there.
Yeah, yeah, and not only that, but the people... New Haven, we care about people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, working in a homeless shelter, people come by and mm-hmm. talk to you, and you find out, oh, that's the mayor. At that time, it was Daniels. Oh, that's the mayor. Oh, that's an alderman. Oh, so, you know, you meet people.
Yeah, I remember Robin Krugman, who was a friend of yours. The late
and Robin Krugman, yes.
So then when you... went to LCI, Liberal City Initiative. You really helped build up that agency as one that kept after slumlords with the resources you had. A lot of times we've been out with you when people were in the middle of the night. We weren't with you in the middle of the night, but we were with you like in the apartments where you made the landlords from out of town pay for, put them in hotels and stuff. When you look back in that experience over 25 years, what did it teach you about what government can and can't do and how to make it work?
Well, it did teach me that government can really impact people's lives mm-hmm. when we monitor government, mm-hmm. we the public, you know. Everybody has to have somebody to answer to. Mm-hmm. In this case, we answer to the public, right? So, and then it did teach me that there are some things that government can't do, and that is take property, you know, unjustifiably so.
Right.
Take property.
Although we did a lot of that before you came to
right, right. And also, you know, any property we take offline is one less place for someone to live.
Yeah.
Right? So
there are limits to what you can do. You got to try to find ways, whether it's sometimes it's education, sometimes it's enforcement, sometimes it's watching. Right. Is there any moment you're proudest of or achievement you're proudest of at LCI?
Oh, yeah. No, I am proud, very proud. You know, we were crunching some numbers the other day, like what did we do during the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
starting like in January to January 2020 to August, and we realized that we were up there close to, you know, something like 14,000 inspections.
In a year and a half.
In a year and a half.
How did you get that many?
Well, the one complaint will give you two inspections, uh-huh. right? The first initial complaint, you go out, you look. Second complaint, you follow up to make sure that things are done. People were home more, so no one was going to work, so people were noticing.
You know, there are ways, you know, Justin Elko was just this press conference talking about how much harder people's lives were in the pandemic. There's no question that's true, especially with, like, being at home, losing jobs. But there was also a lot of government help and a lot of people at home. So there were ways life wasn't harder. Like, I think it's about to get harder now that eviction moratoriums are expiring. Unemployment, extra money is expiring. It turned out hunger did not increase in the pandemic because of all the effort that went through volunteering government to feed people. We had a rally to it.
Right.
I think we had this moment where we saw what government and community together can do to care for people.
Yes.
That we had this crisis and we, with huge exceptions as a country, we made sure people didn't have this tragedy. But now I'm worried that now that we're back to somewhat business as usual. The COVID's now becoming a long-term thing, so people are, like, fighting each other about, like, trying to deal with it. It happened a little before. But, you know, all that money's running out now. They're not going to give us that kind of money. They're not going to protect us from inventories. I'm worried that now people like you are going to have five times as much to do.
So during COVID, everybody was home, right, initially.
And there were ups and downs to that.
And there were ups and downs.
Getting in our neighborhood, sitting on our porch.
Right? You could see what was going on, right?
Yeah.
This needs to be taken care of. That a lot of people worked on their houses. A lot of people just complained about their neighbors. A lot of people found out that some things in their house didn't work right, or there were mechanical problems. But we learned all of that. We never stopped doing our job during COVID. We reduced a little bit the residential license program, which is a proactive program, but then 3 months later, we came right back.
And Babs Rosali writes in, I'm such a Rafael Ramos fan, a true Renaissance man. Thanks, Babs, for listening. Babs is on the mend. Babs had a hip replacement, we're hoping. Second one.
Hi, Babs.
And I think it went well, and we're all praying for her. We love her and can't wait till she gets back to the radio. So anything? So you're really proud about all the work you did in COVID. What about an incident, looking back 25 years? You don't have to pick the one. But tell me about something that happened one day or one night when you said, this is why I do this, and this is how I can make a difference. I'm thinking there were times, like with immigrants, when you found over people, Larry Etelu, this guy from Nigeria who was cramming them in 32 a place. When you had people with the heat going out when they thought they, you know, you wouldn't be able to get them to put them up in hotels.
Mr. Flanagan.
Yep.
So one thing is, I think prior, just when LCI started the old housing code, we really didn't do a lot at night, right? Like other towns, and everyone can verify, you call other towns at night about a heating complaint, and they're going to tell you, they'll call you back in the morning, right? Not in New Haven. In New Haven, I'm very proud to have taken the lead with this. We have, and I'll coin the term I got from Henry Fernandez, we have zero tolerance for no heat. Zero, because
I remember that, yeah.
People do desperate things when they don't have heat. And I remember one night going to a property, a big building on Legion Avenue, and the owner flat out told me that he was not going to repair the furnace.
When was this?
Wow, this is like 1996, 97.
So was he living in there, or was he from out
of town? No, he was absentee, multi-family brick building. And most of the folks that he had living in the buildings were all immigrant workers who didn't know that there's a law and didn't know that we would protect them if they complained, so they didn't complain. By the time I got there, pipes were already frozen, and he was still refusing.
So what'd you do?
Had him arrested.
That night?
That night.
How'd you get him arrested that night?
I called police, and we had him meet us at the property, and they handcuffed him right there.
And what happened that night? How'd you get the heat?
We didn't. We relocated.
But then you charged them for putting them. Where'd you relocate them to?
Right, to hotels, you know.
And what did it feel like when you're there standing up for an immigrant who's scared to report things? You see their kids could be freezing and get really sick. What did it like to have the power to get that landlord to pay?
Well, it's not really about the power, but it's about you help these folks. Like when you get them to the hotel and you go visit them at the hotel and you're taking their survey, you know, and you're finding out who they really, it feels good to see people relieved. You know, there's nothing worse than being cold.
I know.
In an apartment. I mean, yeah. I remember nights where I went out with other people and we put a plastic on people's windows because they were so bad, just trying to keep them warm, those who did not want to leave their apartments. So we do whatever we have to do to make sure people stay safe.
Did you ever feel it was too much, like that you couldn't really help too many of the people who needed the help? There's such widespread bad landlords, old houses.
I don't think it was too much. I think from time to time, it's nice to take a little 5-day vacation or something and then come back.
And you're the kind of person who you probably don't take enough breaks during the week. You probably would work like 80 hours, right?
Yeah.
Did it ever run you down?
I do so many things. I'm a true believer in community service. There's any more service than there's any better service than volunteer community service.
Mm. Okay, we're talking about Rafael Ramos, who, after 25 years, the Livable City Initiative enforcing the housing code, is moving on to a new challenge as the city's new director of environmental health programs starting October 4th. He's ready to make sure that lead paint laws are followed, that the pound of ham you pay for is a pound of ham, that you don't get poisoned buying ribs at the restaurant, and that the beach water, when you go swimming, you're not going to get sick. That's a good way of putting it?
Yeah.
Okay, you talked about, tell me a little bit about immigration. So I kind of feel like you and I have watched, I've been a reporter, you've been in the city, dealing with the growing immigrant community in New Haven since the late 80s, early 90s. And at first it was kind of like in the shadows and would come to your attention because you'd see some people were living illegally. I remember there was a guy, Larry Edelou, would buy all these properties and have someone ship them 20 undocumented people to live in two rooms in a building. You'd get tons of money and send them to go work in some farm for 3 months. And that you'd bust these people. And at first, I think we might not have realized all the issues facing those immigrants. Like, what would be the implications? Like, you got to bust the guy who's cheating. But what about protecting the undocumented workers so they don't get deported? Did you have to figure out how to do that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, we build our pot. You know, we had to realize early in the game that that was not our job, that we were not immigration services.
Yeah.
We were not ICE, that, you know, our job is to protect the health and safety of our residents. And these folks are our residents, and they work, and they rent, and they pay their rent. And so we early on said we will not do the work of ICE. That's not what we do. We have to protect
that's immigrant
cause. Right.
But what about dangers people are put in? So people are scared to call you in the first place. They don't want to be deported.
Right.
But how did you make sure you're going to hold the criminal, greedy landlords who are exploiting them accountable without endangering? Like, I remember first when I'd write about it, we put the pictures of the immigrants. And then we realized that might not always be a good idea unless they really want to talk and have their picture.
Right.
That they wanted to stay in the shadows and we went on to out them. How did you, were there times at first when you had to learn that? Like, how you were going to make sure they didn't pay the price?
Yeah, you have to, win their confidence and their trust immediately by letting them know, look, I don't care where, you know, what your status is here in this country. What I do care is about you.
Well, what happened to them? Like, when you got a landlord who was illegally bringing in busloads of people through some networks of middlemen and putting them in really dangerous 20. I remember that one place on East Rock with the 20 people in the apartment, then the other one on Ferry Street.
Oh, this just came to me. Yeah, on Ferry Street. I remember
Ferry Street, you and I were there in the
90s.
Yeah,
we opened the closet door. The guy was sleeping in the closet. Yeah. We opened the closet door and the top of his body, the torso fell back and hit the floor. And I couldn't believe it. I thought he was dead. But then I realized that he was sleeping, but that he had actually rented that closet.
Yeah.
So
the people renting it were doing something horrible and making no money on it. But how do we make sure that guy still got to do what he wanted to do? In other words, what would happen to him once you bust the landlord?
We relocated them like we would anybody else.
And he got to stay and still work. I think they worked right tobacco field in Northwestern.
The buses used to pick them up. What we had to do was, first of all, we had to downsize the number of people so that they could free up room so other people can stay, right? So we put some people in hotels, other people, we help them find other rooms.
I remember counting the 20 on Eagle Street.
Yeah.
I remember in a couple of rooms there were 20 people.
Yeah.
But they chose to do that, you know? So the question is, like, they're not the villains. The villains are the greedy guys who are taking advantage of them.
Right. And not only that, but even if they're telling you, in some cases they do it because it makes it more affordable, right? But still, I think that the property owners still have a responsibility to say, no, we do have a code and there's too many people.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that was the 90s. And it really started, I believe, around 2000 when Junta for Progressive Action, which had been a dormant organization, was revived under the leadership of Kika Matos, who came to town.
Right.
And you had this community board, people like you and Norma Franceschi. There were a whole bunch of people who said, when you talk about volunteer, we're going to help you make this a good organization again. So you're helping young people, you took them camping, but you also embraced this growing new population of Latino immigrants. And you, I think, created the way so that when the inspector goes in, that's not the beginning and end of the story, but there's a whole network of people who are advocating for and helping immigrants so they can become part of our community, whether it's getting driver's license, where they feel comfortable going to the police when they get ripped off with their money. So
the
immigrant IDs, right? So it's kind of interesting how you both worked on that from a government position and a volunteer position.
Right.
Now, you grew up Puerto Rican. Did you speak Spanish?
Yes.
Did you have any kind of connection to the immigrants who are coming in from Latin America because of that, or is that just a completely different world, people? Because, I mean, Puerto Rico's part of America. You grew up here.
I grew up in New York City where everybody comes to New York City. I don't care what part of the world you're coming from, right? So, and then, of course, I'm also conscious that when Puerto Ricans first came here in the, you know, by the droves in the 30s and 40s. Nobody put out the welcome mat for them either, right?
Okay, that's a good point.
You know, so
But wasn't there some resistance, not you, but weren't there some people in the Puerto Rican community that was dominant in New Haven, Latino community? Didn't they have some kind of hesitation at first, some people, like especially leaders, about the immigrant community because they saw them as a different group of people, or no?
There was a little bit of that with the old vanguard, a little, but not much. Because, I mean, what we had a lot in common with our new immigrants was we all spoke the same language.
Yeah, and Hunter was such a great beginning place of that, and then it spread out with activist groups that were spawned from that.
Right.
I remember Nora Franceschi had the grocery deli on Main Street in Fairhaven. And wasn't that sort of like an unofficial place also?
It wasn't
the social service organization, Hunter community organization. It was sort of like the unofficial way she'd help you find people and get help.
That was the Fairhaven mayor's office.
Yeah.
That's what that was. Yes. But, like, I think that that's what makes New Haven such a great place, that we care about people.
I agree. And, you know, and we don't do it for this reason. But I believe, and we can't prove it definitively, that it helped our economy. When Danbury said, all you Ecuadorians leave, and we said, come here, and they had a consulate. When the FBI and ICE tried to intimidate us into turning in people, we said, no, we're going to protect people. Don't you think Fairhaven, as a result, where so many immigrants moved, that the commercial area improved so much, and so many of the immigrants who put effort into building their houses, or just, they're here because they want to be here, they're working hard, they're often not getting much, if any, public assistance, that I thought that kind of turned around our economy.
I think
that's not why you do it. You do it because it's the right thing.
Right. But Grand Avenue is the most vibrant avenue.
And it wasn't like that
when you
started.
Yeah.
When you came in 96, it was beat.
Right, it was beat down. Yeah.
A lot of vacancies.
You can go and get a healthy juice.
Yeah.
You know, I forgot the name of the building and the name of the business. And
isn't it right on the same block as what used to be Christopher Columbus Academy? Yeah, I noticed two of those
block
places
over.
Yesterday. Yep.
One block over. But you can get a fresh juice with fresh
vegetables and fruits.
Vegetables and it's just amazing, like an apple juice or a green juice. I get this thing called a monster.
What's a monster?
I think it has kale, apples, you know, a little ginger. It's amazing. But you can get that, a healthy drink, right on Grand Avenue. It's very vibrant.
I noticed a lot of restaurants. Some had been there before, but a lot were newer.
Family-owned businesses.
Yeah.
You know, with kids working behind the counter and stuff. I think it's exciting.
How's the Hill doing? It seems like it's struggling a little more. And that's the second biggest area where there's immigration. Why is that?
The Hill doesn't really have a strong
identity.
A strong sort of business corridor.
Kimberly Ave, you have Howard Ave, you have Congress Ave, but you're right, those are all kind of stop after a couple of blocks. And then you have like the App Foundation or you have the some kind of vacant blocks or else the whole stretch of the just residential places.
And we have one business over here and the other business five blocks.
So you think it's about commercial center?
I think there's no real commercial corridor.
There's all this talk always over the years about improving those corridors, Congress Ave, Kimberly Ave, but it hasn't taken the same way.
No. There's not enough commercial space, right? I don't see enough storefronts. It's not like the storefronts are there and they're vacant. They don't exist.
Mm. Is it chicken the egg a little bit?
Yeah, kind of thing.
But you're right. That Grand Avenue was created by two other waves of immigrants over 100 years as a real commercial center. And it had that mix of residential and storefront together.
Right.
But is there also a difference in the natures of the communities?
Do you get
as many complaints? Do people engage with government as much in the Hill?
I think so.
Yeah?
I think so, yeah. It's just, to me, it's the lack of economic development because the infrastructure is not there.
And now it's creeping in from that downtown crossing where they're rebuilding, filling in the highway. I noticed that the Oilers negotiated, and you kind of see it at the edges. There's stuff being built where they filled in those blocks have been vacant for decades on Washington Avenue. Right. But as you're getting closer to downtown, so you're not really in the heart of the Hill.
Right.
But
it's getting
there,
and that's going to help. Well, the thing is that I think the development in the 70s, right, all that development in the 70s.
When they knocked down all the stuff. Yeah.
They disconnected neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So I like to use the term pedestrian continuity. There is none going that way.
Right.
But there is going towards East Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's things to see, you know, you don't want to walk to Grand Avenue because you have that big void.
Right.
Between, you know, that whole sort of industrial park going up Grand Avenue. So those kind of things I think are bad for the cities.
And how are we doing at the other end of Fairview? We're talking about like Grand Avenue closer to downtown, starting with Farnham Courts, then going where it's been a little beat, where Project Moore is and stuff. What do you think we need to do there?
I think we need to get more businesses. I think we need, you know, those little malls they built in the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
I think they need to turn those back down on, to looking on the street, maybe.
I agree.
You know, businesses on the first floor, affordable residentials above, you know.
All right, we're talking to Rafael Ramos, New Haven, Dateline New Haven at WNHH-FM. Tell me how Bergamo's is going. When did you start that community group? You've done so many great shows there. You have the space at Erector Square. You've done it in other buildings around town. Original plays that get written. What? Tell me what you're up to with that these days.
Well, we're just getting back into things. In fact, we have a show on the 25th and the 26th. We have these three fantastic comedian women.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do a show outdoor in the parking lot. We're creating an outdoor sort of amphitheater.
At Erector Square?
At Erector Square.
And where are these women from?
They're from Chicago.
And what's the idea? Is it Bergamo's coming back from the pandemic? Or?
Well, the idea is to do what we can before it gets too cold and we have to go indoors.
We'll be able to go indoors, won't we? Or the tight space is too tight for what you do?
No, we could go indoors, but you lose people when they know they have to wear a mask. Or you lose people when you may have to take their temperature. And then you lose people when you ask them if you're not vaccinated, stay home.
How do you do that? And you work in a lot of communities where the vaccination rate is low. What are you observing? Are you observing any of that? You're going to be in public health. You're not going to be in the vaccination side.
No,
did you work on that Fairhaven campaign to get people vaccinated?
Well, I'm still at Junta as a board member, and I know that
we've
been doing a lot of things. And just the other day, they had a record vaccination of 40 or something.
Oh, good.
But,
so Hunter's one place where you're getting the trust.
Yeah.
But they did well in Fairhaven, didn't they? I mean, they had a community campaign.
Yeah,
Kika Matos, Sarah Miller.
Kika Matos and those guys went door to door, actually.
Right. And got hundreds of people in New Haven to do that.
Right.
Where you kind of feel good that you're part of something bigger.
Right.
And they got the numbers up.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
See, so many good things do happen in New Haven. How about music? You've been playing your music lately?
I've been all around town on the drum, on the conga drum, wherever we get a chance. And we just did the Elm City Lit Fest.
That was great. Oh, you were involved in that?
We were the opening group that drummed for them.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How'd that go?
It went very well. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful day, too. Good turnout.
Yeah, our reporter there said it was great.
Yeah, I'm very proud to be right on the beginning of that's going to be an incredible legacy that Elm City Lit.
Tell me about that. It's the second year they did it, first year in person. They brought people both locally and nationally. 7 hours in one day of people doing spoken word and music the back there.
And then families around and vendors and people talking to each other, which I think the pandemic sort of kept people away from each other, But people talking, just happy to see each other. A beautiful day. It's amazing. And we were so honored to be the opening act to play for them and sort of bring in the spirits with our drumming.
And you did that for Scholar Park, too, when people were coming back reclaiming the park.
Yeah, Scholar Park as well.
You know, Rafael, some of the work you do in government and civic, it's without blinders. You're seeing some of the most challenging aspects of our community and that you always bring a sense of optimism that we can tackle it and feel good as a community and not just like getting rid of problems, but making a good city to live in. I admire so much the work you did. I've been watching it since the last century. And I'm so excited that you're about to embark on a new challenge.
Thank you.
At 64 years old, after 25 years in the city, as you now take on a strengthened and renewed public health mission in New Haven to tackle lead paint, inspections of restaurants, our water quality, and our weights and measures, you're going to hit it out of the park. So you don't need any good wishes for me, but I give them to you anyway, Rafael Ramos.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on WNHH-FM. Thank you, Harry Dross, our station manager, operating remotely but still keeping the trains running. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience. You know those guys?
Yeah.
I like those guys.
I learned from you. They're amazing.
Yeah. They're taking out playing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day and all night at WNHH. New Haven's home for community radio.